Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. Mike here at the top of this week's episode to introduce this week's guest, Adam Denston. You may be familiar with Adam as one half of the Gogglebox Australia duo, Adam and Simon. Adam and Simon have been on Gogglebox since it started here in Australia. They did take one season off and they are now back on the show. Currently, though, Adam and Simon have a lot going on, including the Adam and Simon podcast, the Adam and Simon show over on Listener, as well as that they have two shows on KO, The Rundown, where they talk about the week in cricket in a super relaxed way, as well as The Clubhouse, where, again, if you're into cricket, you can watch Big Bash League games live with Adam and Simon on KO or YouTube Live. Comment and interact in real time. As well as that, you can follow Adam on Instagram at Adam Denston and find out what he and Simon are up to there. If you like Willosophy and want to support us for as little as a dollar a month, you can go to patreon.com/willosophy, get these episodes one day early and completely ad-free. We would appreciate all of your support there. You can also follow us on Instagram at WillosophyPod. Check out all the amazing artwork from James Fosdyke, our artist. And as well as that, WillosophyPod on Twitter. Let us know what you thought about these episodes. Will also has a bunch of shows on sale. So if you do happen to be in Brunswick Heads, Sydney or Brisbane, there are currently some shows for sale from Will Anderson. Head to willanderson.com to buy tickets to those shows. And that's about all I have to plug. So without further ado, here is Will Anderson and Adam Denston talking on Willosophy. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the show starts. I ask my guest who they are. So who are you?
I'm Adam Denston, and I like to tell people that I'm the only Adam Denston in the entire world. That's what I like to tell people. Whether it's true or not, I'm not sure, but I think I'm the only one in the world.
So, okay. Well, I think that sometimes you would stumble upon another Adam Denston because you're somebody, Adam, who we'll get to, but you have some public profile now. You know, you're the most famous Adam Denston in the world. I'm going to lock that in. You may not be the only okay. Adam Denston in the world, but I'm locking you in for number one most famous Adam Denston. And the fact that you're not getting some other Adam Denston's mail at the moment. My friend Justin Hamilton, who's a comedian and my best friend, he has currently been mistaken for a coach online for a huge American college football team, and he's been getting a lot of like congratulations messages and stuff from the team, and he's just been responding to them all as if he is the coach. And the other day he went on like their college radio and talked about the whole thing. So I assume you would have been contacted by another Adam if there was one at this point.
No, never not once. So the reason that I like to tell people that I'm the only Adam Denston is my pa did like the genealogy family history thing. My pa, who's now passed away, but he did the history of the family and where we all came from and that kind of thing. And so from what he researched and from what he found, there was only one other family of Denstons spelt the same way as mine. In the world, and they're in New Jersey, and there was no Adams in that family at that time. So I think I'm the only one. And I actually met someone, I met an old lady, she was like 85, might have even been 90, and her last name was Enston, spelt the same way as ours, but without the D. And she said that her family were from an English town called Enstone, and that it was a bastardization of that. So I think that my family has become a bastardization of her family's bastardization of the town that they're from in England.
Yeah, your family thought they were a bit fancier. You were probably the Denstons for a while, and then it just became Denston. Yeah. So that's fascinating to me, though, because it is weird to have such a unique name. Like, you know, the idea that you're never going to run into other people who share your last name. Was that a... Did that define your childhood in any way? I think it's always unusual because you've got quite a common boy's first name, right? Like Adam,
Mary.
The original man name. So, you know, right there from the start. But like a really distinctive surname. How does your name define who you are, if at all, is my question to you?
Well, I think because it's like, you're right, it's unique in its spelling. And I don't think, because there's not many, or because there's no other Denstons around the world, or not many other ones, but it's still not like unique enough for it to, for people to comment on it. Right. Like if, like when I say my name's Adam Denston, people go, oh yeah, fair enough. And then they'll always spell it with an O-N, but no one's going like, geez, yeah, that's right. Interesting. They go, oh yeah, cool. Boring, white man enough. Take that and run with it. So I think it, maybe it's helped me just blend into the background, or blend into the middle, which is where I generally sit.
Okay, well, other than being an original and only one, who else are you, Adam? Tell me, like, you know how this podcast works. I like to get a little description of how people, if we met at a party and I asked you who you were, what would you say?
I probably would use the, my now wife uses the descriptor that I'm a city guy with a country heart. So I grew up in a small town called Corowa. So there's about 5,000 people or so. Other famous Corowa people are Taylor Duray, current Western Bulldogs footballer. Yeah. So I played junior football with him. The Houlihan brothers got heaps of footballers. And then the actor John Howard was born in Corowa as well. So yeah, but still very much a guy who needs to live in the city for the stimulation, but who very much has been brought up with country values. That's how I like to think of myself anyway.
Okay, so tell me what life was like for you then when you were a kid. Did you live in the same place that whole time? Like, what did your like parents do? Like, what was life like there?
So it was very charmed. It's probably the only way you could describe it. Like, it is, if I was to go on SAS, that the show on Channel 7, like, no one would be able to hammer me with any questions about, like, controversy of my life, because we lived a few hundred metres from the river. My brother's 4 years older than me. My sister's 3 years older. She's got some learning disabilities and learning difficulties and development delay. So mum's her full-time carer, but she can do everything herself. She just, mum was her carer. And then my dad was a banker in town. And even though it is a small town, it's like quite a farming town. There's lots of like, I love all the small towns around there, like Losedale and Baldale and Oaklands, and they've all got like 12 people in them and they're brilliant. I love those towns, but I was unfortunately a townie, and so we lived close to the river. So did spend a whole lot of time like camping and all that kind of thing. But I feel like I've ticked off all the country guy stuff. Like, I've shorn a sheep, I've driven a harvester, and then I've spent a night on a farm. So I was like, oh, close enough, country guy, but now I'm moved to the big smoke.
Do you ever milk a cow?
No, not a lot of dairy farms close to us. There's a lot of like wheat and a lot of sheep, but not a lot of dairy farms. And I know you're from a dairy farm, so maybe I can put that on my list.
All right. You ever go to a bachelor and spinster's ball?
No, the B&S ball was quite a big thing in town. But so I grew up in Corowa, moved there. We moved from Wangaratta when I was, born in Sale, then lived in Bairnsdale for a year.
Born in the Gippsland-based hospital in Sale?
Potentially. All I remember is that my brother would say that you were for sale, and that's how we got you as a part of our family.
I believe what we've just learned about each other is we were born in the same hospital.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, how about that? And I was born in the Gippsland-based hospital, which is the only big real hospital in Sale, I imagine. So I imagine we were literally born in the same hospital. Okay.
There you go. I'll take that. I'll take that for sure. And then we moved to Wangaratta and then Corowa, and I lived there until I was 19 and moved out. But I went to high school in Wangaratta, which is sort of 40 minutes away from home. So it was, yeah, very, very charming. We'd spend time down the river. Like, weekends were sport the whole time. Incredibly, yeah, fortunate. I try and use the word, actually incredibly lucky, because I try and frame a lot of the stuff that I do as, this is more recent, I try and frame it as fortunate rather than lucky, because lucky sort of implies that I had no say in whatever has happened, which I was incredibly lucky to grow up in the family, really supportive, lots of fun, lots of smiles and love and everything. But then I try and, with everything that I do now, I try and frame it as I'm really fortunate to be in the positions that I am, to give myself that little bit of, like, I guess it's a bit of empowerment to myself that I've also had some say in how I've got to where I am now.
Yeah, I think this is something that people struggle with all the time, and I think you've unlocked it in a really cool way, which is legitimately feeling like they've earned something themselves. But if we want to have a conversation around things like, you know, privilege and, you know, structural inequality and all these things, which are also true, like, you know, misogyny, you know, sexism, whatever the things might be that are also in this conversation, then the way that you put it, which is, I am fortunate, like I maybe have worked hard to get this thing or live this sort of life or be with this sort of person, but I appreciate that this is a good opportunity for me to have. Like, that's a cool way of looking at it. I dig that.
Yeah, so I think that particularly with work and jobs and things that we've got along the way is that you are lucky to be in the position for the thing to occur and for someone to ask the question, but for then you to take that idea and say yes to it and then put in the work to then get to that next level, that's when I like to say that I'm really fortunate to be in the position that I am. So, but yeah, like you said, there's a whole lot of luck in that I was born a white male in the country with like a really loving and supporting family. Like that's an incredible step up to a lot of people that have not only in society, but in the rest of the world as well.
So, okay. So what takes you from the country to the city then? Because if you talk about this defining characteristic, being this country kid, but like needing the city, what were the bright lights of the city? What's the first memory you have of going to the city? Did it capture your attention the first time you ever visited it?
Well, I just have vague memories along the way of like using the Melways with Dad, sitting in the car, being like working our way past street to street. But I remember it was always a big thing to make a whole trip because obviously you got to load the car up with three kids. But I think one of the most vivid memories I have of my teenage years was standing in the lounge room. And so I studied physiotherapy and the plan was always to go to uni once I got out of high school. My brother's a plumber, but like I have the worst hands ever. So he's got all, I tell everyone that he's got the hands skills and I've got the brain skills. That's what I tell him anyway. But we were in the lounge room and mum, because there's a physio course in Albury, and mum said to me, you should go and study in Albury because then you can stay close to home and we can see you all the time. And I remember stamping my feet around the ground and I said, mum, I am bigger than this town. Like a petulant child that I was, or petulant teenager, said, I'm bigger than this town. I need to get out of here. Let me go. And then I stormed off into my room, slammed a couple of doors, and then went down and probably lied and cried into my pillow for a little bit as well.
What do you think that was? I'm always interested in what that thing inside, because the journey that my life has taken me on, I sometimes reflect on it and go, what the confidence of that kid, like the blind confidence of that kid living on Anderson's Road in Denison, who went to see Billy Connolly and thought, I could do that, I reckon. Like ridiculous, like so stupid, like just like, but what was it inside you? What was that feeling, do you think?
I think a lot of it was instilled particularly from Dad. So my old man, his old man was in the Navy and they lived all around the world. They lived in Scotland and Singapore, and then he worked in the bank in Darwin, and he has always told us all these incredible stories about Darwin, and that's like where all these big group of mates are from, and they're still really close today. And Dad worked in like Papua New Guinea for a while, like helped people set up banking in Papua New Guinea. And then he was always like, you need to see the world, you need to go out. So I think it was always just like something that was, yeah, he told us and instilled in us from a young age that the world is big and you should see as much of it as you can while you can. So I think that was it. And maybe him telling me that year after year had sort of ingrained something in me where I was like, I need to get out of this town. 5,000 is not enough for me, and 17,000 in Wangaratta is not enough either. So it's my time to leave.
Okay, so where do you go? How old are you and where do you go?
So not finish high school, take a year off just to earn some money so I can support myself when I move to Melbourne. It's funny because the thought was never Sydney. The thought was never any other city than Melbourne. And I think that's because Cairo was a border town and all those border towns are Victorian anyway. And so Sydney's sort of 7 hours away versus Melbourne being only 3 or 4. But take a year off, work in the Commonwealth Bank of all places for 12 months as a teller, and then...
Same bank as your dad? Was your dad Commonwealth Bank as well?
He was, yep. I mean, I wouldn't like... I'd say that nepotism was pretty strong.
Okay, yeah. I wasn't going to ask that question, but I thought this says either that there was nepotism involved or you were branching out on your own. You know, you're like, fuck you, Dad. I'm going to go and work at Westpac. They've got a helicopter.
Well, no, the thing was that So Dad didn't work at the bank. He wasn't still working there when I got the job there. But the guy that employed me, Dad employed him like 20 years ago. So, I mean, it didn't not help me get the job, put it that way.
Yeah.
And then convinced a mate to go with me overseas for 5 weeks to Europe before I moved down to Melbourne, and I moved into Newman College at Melbourne Uni. So just one of the ones on the Swanston Street Bend, and that was just the best 2 years of my life for sure. It was awesome.
Okay, so what is, I mean, you know, as much as you want to share, but what is it about it that was so awesome? Like when you look back on that time so fondly, you can see it on your face when you talk about it.
Yeah.
Like what are the memories that come to mind?
I think a lot of it is the one, independence. Even though I had a lot of independence, I was still living at home in my gap year, but I was driving to and from Wangaratta every day for work. But I think a combination of the independence, seeing a new city, but also just the sheer number of people. So my primary school year was 18 kids. There was 8 boys and 10 girls. And then our high school year was another step up. I think there was 100 in our year 12, but our group was probably only about 10. And then you go to college and you get there. And like, I mean, you can reinvent yourself because like, I mean, I didn't hate high school, but I certainly didn't love it. I don't think I ever really found my proper place. I think I was quite happy. I was never, didn't want to lead, but I also didn't want to like head out into the background or head out at the tail end. So I was always somewhere in the middle in terms of like the popularity of the group kind of thing. But then when you get to to college and you get to Melbourne, mate, no one knows who you were at high school. So you can sort of run your own race again and reinvent yourself. So I think I just really love that. And I found blokes and girls who were really, really similar to us. And there's, three or four that are still some of my closest mates of the guys that I met at college. So I think that's part of the reason.
Okay. So I'm interested in the reinvention because did you immediately, you know, understand which direction you were going in with the reinvention, or did you try a bunch of things on first to see which ones fit you?
I reckon I tried a few on, because there's all these like college turbos that go in there and they go really hard and that kind of thing. I knew I didn't want to be one of those. But so my first memory was on O week of heading into college, and I left the first day of O week. The arrogance to leave the first day of O week when there's the biggest party, I left because I was like, oh, I'm going to Good Vibes Festival and I'm going with my brother and we're going to see the Killers. They're playing for the last time ever. They're breaking up. Turns out they get together about 4 or 5 more times.
You'll see them sing with Jack Rewald at the AFL Grand Final.
So I left that, and then I think I just found, but I found the guys that I wanted to be friends with quite quickly. And then we just bonded. Mate, I look back on there now and I was like, what did you do with all the time? Like I had 20 contact hours of science, so Bachelor of Science to start off with. And I just was like, mate, your food's made for you. Someone came in and cleaned our rooms once a week, vacuumed the rooms once a week. So it was, again, incredibly fortunate, but it was awesome because part of the reason that I was always wanted to go to Melbourne Uni primarily because it was in the city. I was like, I don't want to be out in Bundoora. I don't want to be out at Monash. I want to be right in the heart of it. But the reason why I took that year off was so I could save enough money so mum and dad didn't have to fully support me financially, that I could get on that youth allowance, and that would pay a lot of the money for the Newman fees, and then I could get a couple of scholarships and work my way through there. So it made it a little bit easier, and it was just, I'd go home in the holidays, work at the bank again in the uni holidays for 4 to 6 weeks, and then come back to college, and I'd just have, I had more money because I'd work for 4 to 6 weeks while I was at home, and it meant I could do whatever we want. We'd go to live music. The only band that's doing live music in Wangaratta is doing covers of Jessie's Girl like every single Saturday. So I think just eyes were fully opened, especially after going overseas. Man, I thought I was the coolest guy ever. I'd been over to Europe for 5 weeks. So it was, mate, I've seen it all. I've seen the Eiffel Tower, you know, whatever. I've seen Sagrada Familia. It's not even finished, like whatever. It was just really, really incredible, incredible fun. But like I said, we just had so much time. Because you'd skip half your classes.
Mm. No, I did journalism. I had 8 contact hours a week and I would skip classes. like 2 days a week. I basically went to uni on the weekends and then had 5 days off, and I would still skip classes.
So were you at college?
No, I went to uni in Canberra.
But was there, because there's colleges in Canberra.
Yeah, but not in the same way as they are at Melbourne University. Like there is residential colleges, but they're not coming in and vacuuming your room once a week. Yeah. Like,
that makes it sound a lot better than it was. Really, a lady would come in. Our cleaner was called Mo. Mo would do our room and she would come in and she would like vacuum around the clothes on the floor and then leave. So there'd be like one small, very, very small path that could go in. But it was funny because so Newman, the college that I went to is like known as the Catholic college. It's known as the Christian college. And so the rumor was always like, ah, if you've got a girl in your room and you get caught, you're going to get expelled. Make sure you know when your cleaning day is. Like because if the cleaner comes in and finds you, they'll rat you out and that kind of thing. To be honest, mate, never had an issue with that anyway. So it was just always, yeah, like we just would go into the dining room and it's beautiful. So like Newman, I don't know, you might not have ever been there, but it's designed by Walter Burley Griffin.
I have, because I used to live in North Carlton for years, like Pigden Street just down by Princess Park and beautiful part of the world. And it was my early 20s. So like from like 21 to 25 or whatever. So like, you know, walked every bit of the graveyard, every bit of the university, beautiful. Just like such a beautiful, peaceful, like that university in general is just such a nice place to go and sit down. It is stunning.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And then Newman, because Newman was designed by Walter Burley Griffin, the architect of Canberra, the dining hall is stunning. It's this massive domed, like wooden, there's all this amazing art and things around there, which you don't appreciate at the time. But there's all like the stupid college traditions and stuff that you do. Like we did, there wasn't a lot of like hazing and all of the negative things that you hear out of it. Like I had a really great time. So one of my favorite things was, so we win... There's the intercollegiate sports, so you play against all the other colleges. Newman plays against Hilders and Queens, and Alex Dyson went to Hilders, and he was a couple of years above me, but you play against them. And in our footy year, we played against Hilders in the final, and they're our rivals. So we're known as the country Catholics, and they're the Catholics that get on the piss a little bit more than we do. And so we'd won like most of the premierships between us in the last 10 years. And then the year that I played... I was the captain of the footy team, which was so much fun. We won the game by 4 points in the mud. And then to celebrate when you win a premiership in the massive dome, you have formal dinners. So everyone has to wear full suit and an academic gown Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights. And on the Wednesday night after you win the premiership, they get all of the students that are in Newman to sit in the dining hall around the circular tables. They clear all of the cutlery and all of the crockery and all the plates off the tables. The premiership team stands outside the door and then bangs on the door. It's known as a bang-in. And then all of the students start banging the table. And so there's like 100, 200 people like banging their wooden tables. And you walk into the room and just like walk a circle around the room as like everybody's cheering for you and shouting and yelling. And it's normally like a really like formal place. But the memory of that walking around, you're like carrying the cup, but you feel like gladiator. Like it's awesome.
Okay. So I'm fascinated by this. Let me start with this question and then I'm going to move on to the aspect of ritual and what's important about that. But you were captain of the team. So what was it about you that made you the captain of the team? Like, were you the best player? Were you the best communicator? Were you well liked by people? Was there an election? Did you seize power in a bloody coup, like from the previous leader? How did you ascend to that position of captain of the team?
Well, the coach is always one of the guys or two of the guys who've left from the previous year. Uh-huh. So the guys that were generally the captain will then be the coach for the following year. So I got picked. So my footy philosophy was always every farmer needs a sheepdog. So I was never going in and getting. Never had a hard ball in my life, which is ironic because I had three concussions and that's why I had to retire from footy. But I would always be on the outside, and my skills were pretty good. That was definitely my strong suit. And then there was always guys who were better than me, but I think it was. Mate, probably just the loudest, I reckon. I reckon that was probably it.
Did you have a leadership style? Did you think much about the way that you led, or was it instinctual?
I think it was only because like of all the junior footy that I've played all throughout my life, the loudest guy was always the best. It's funny. Except when the one thing that I wouldn't do would be the pre-game rev up. I was happy to pass the pre-game rev up off to the angry guy who's always like, we owe these blokes, like, we hate them, we hate Hilders. Look at them, look at it, look at those slobs over there. They probably got pissed last night. So I would always leave that to someone else. But there's a video that we've still got, like grainy footage of the ball being rebounded from one end to the other, and we kicked the goal in the square. And there was, that night was chaos, absolute chaos. And the photo from our footy team is still in the Clyde pub on the corner of Elgin Street. So there's still a couple of photos there, which is funny because there's Uni Blues, like all these guys who seriously play footy. And then there's like two Newman photo premierships of like us, like scrawny, skinny 19-year-olds sitting there with a premiership cap.
I'm so fascinated by this, genuinely fascinated by this, because it's something I admire in people. Because for me, this whole, like the playing the footy game, absolutely love it. Every other thing you've described is a fucking nightmare to me. The idea that I have to dress up in a suit, I've got some sort of fucking cape on, people, like there's heaps of people there, they're banging shit, like we're walking around. But I also love from the outside that other people love ritual and celebration. And it's actually something that I don't look at that and go, oh, I'm, yeah, I look down my nose at that sort of thing. I actually look at it like I wish that there was an aspect of my personality that would connect with that and find that joyful. Because when you see people express it, it is joyful. And the way that you're talking about these memories are absolutely filled with the joy of remembering these moments. So talk to me about what it is, just like, can you get to the heart of what it is about that that is really compelling?
Well, I think for me, a couple of things. I think ritual itself is not so much as important as the memory that that ritual creates. So like the fact that there is a ritual really just creates an avenue for a memory and a particularly a cherished memory to be held inside you and be talked about. And because I know that when I get together with all the Newman boys, we talk about the glory days and that kind of thing. But I think that combined with the fact that, and this probably also speaks to why I needed/wanted to get out of a small town, was that like the older I get, the more clearly I understand that I am extroverted in that I get my energy from being around other people. So the larger the crowd, or not necessarily the larger the crowd, but the more people that I'm around and that I feel connected to, the more sort of life force that gives me. And remembering those times is a way to sort of build that life force in me without actually having to have the people around me at the time. Like remembering that story now fills me with joy because I remember the people that I was with, the memories that were created and the laughs and everything that we had along the way. So I think that, yeah, ritual itself can be, and it can be a little bit wanky and it can be looked down upon, but for me, yeah, it's not the ritual that does it. It's the memory that then is created as a result of.
I mean, the reason I was thinking about it, to be honest, was I was watching footage of people going to the Met Gala ball, you know, very fancy,
yes,
you know, American dress-up ball. And just there was no part of me that was like, you could invite me personally. The head of the Met Gala could send me a personal invitation and I'd be like, no fucking thank you. So
well,
hard work.
I think when I watch that, like I see the people, I'm like, mate, you could dress up as anything and they'd be like, oh, wow, so thoughtful. You could be like, you could dress up as a genuine banana and people be like, oh, look, there's so much meaning to it. There's like the yellow that represents the sunshine that's not in the world at the moment and like the shape that's not straight. And like you could do anything and people are going to think you're the best thing ever.
Here's what I'll tell you, because I had a job when I was starting out in my show business career, dressing up as a banana and handing out flyers around banana awareness of some kind. I don't know, bananas, they're good for you or something. And the two things that I realized in my stint as being a giant banana in a shopping center was that A, for whatever reason, there are a certain subset of mum shoppers who find a man in a giant costume alluring, regardless of the fact that they really can't see his face. And the other one is kids love punching you in the nuts, or just where your nuts would be on a banana. It's amazing.
So were you head out, arms out, banana for the body? Like how was the setup?
Arms out, yeah, legs out, but then the entire rest of your body is banana. So no face out. Like only like, you know, a little hole to see through. No, Yeah, no.
I would say that that's probably almost more ripe for the kicking in the nuts area when they can't see your face. Like if you're a face, you're a person.
Yeah.
If your eyes behind a mask, you're a banana. Yeah. I'm going to kick the banana in the nuts.
Exactly. Those kids grow up to be Twitter trolls. Anonymous Twitter trolls. Won't even put their names on it. Okay, so you have great days at university. How about educationally? Did you find it a nourishing experience as like an educational experience?
To be honest, probably not.
Mm.
Like I was lucky. I'll try and use that luck and fortune. I'll try and be quite pointed when I use them. But I think I was lucky enough initially that I didn't find, like, school wasn't particularly super difficult for me at all. Like, I wasn't one of the kids that needed to do or wanted to do 3 hours of homework a night. And I sort of cruised through a lot of it and then was able to get the academic marks that I needed to get to wherever I wanted to go. And then, ended up at Melbourne Uni. And so I did science and got through science without too much trouble and then had the marks to get into the postgrad physio course there as well. And so got through that relatively easy. But it was never the academia was never the stimulating thing for me. It was everything that was associated with it. And I was fortunate to do a whole lot of travel. So my year was always geared around travel. So I would work for that 4 to 6 weeks in the middle of the year. And at the end of the year, I would travel anywhere I could go with my mate who lived in Newcastle and was studying medicine, my best mate from high school, Nick, that we met. Yeah, we met in high school. And then we would travel every year from, it was like 2010 to 2019. We went every year to somewhere or the other. So that was always the gear. It was always not, I'm really stimulated by learning about mitochondria and the things that I do. Because for me, learning, I'm quite a good rote learner, and I pick up on concepts relatively quickly, but then I just never really had the drive to take it to that next level. So like I was terrible at physics, couldn't understand the concepts that well because I didn't get them that quickly. But in terms of biology and chemistry and that kind of thing, which was much more just, hey, remember this, I was like, yeah, cool, I can remember that. So I think that's easy enough. Sit, look, cover, right, check, sit down there. Not much trouble at all. But in terms of sitting down and then taking it to that next level, that was never really something that I wanted to do.
Okay, so I'm interested in the travel aspect because, two things. You're currently in Melbourne, if you don't mind me saying that,
yep.
in a lockdown situation, one of the world's biggest lockdowns, Melbourne's been through. Obviously, the idea of traveling like interstate in Australia has been an issue, let alone the idea of traveling overseas. Is it something that like you really miss in your life, the fact that you can't travel?
I think so, but I also think I definitely do miss it. So some of the places, like I've been really, really fortunate to go to, we went to Jordan, which was one of the best places we went to, like trekked for 10 days through the desert. That was heaps of fun. It's also really hard to talk about travel and not sound really wanky.
It's hard to appear on this podcast and not sound really wanky. This is a very safe space for please sound as wanky as you possibly can.
So I think I was fortunate to go to I ticked off a lot of the stuff that I wanted to do at the age that I wanted to do it. So we did a couple of, the first trip was to Europe and then did a trip to India. We went to Southeast Asia, went to Japan, went to the States a couple of times, went to South America. So I did all of those and I think I got a lot of it, like a lot of the stuff I wanted to out of my system that the yearning that I would have if I hadn't done them, I think a lot of that has been lessened or mitigated to some extent anyway.
What's the scariest moment you ever had in traveling?
Funnily enough, today there's an earthquake in Melbourne. We were in an earthquake in Mexico City, but that wasn't the scariest one. 2 days later, we were on a bus trip in the middle of the night and we're just taking some sleeping tablets to get through the 17-hour overnight bus trip. Rather than pay $70 to fly, we paid $20 to get the 17-hour bus trip. And our bus was going 70 Ks down a road and it hit a cow or hit a bull. And so we're in a bus crash and we pulled over on the side of the road and there was a genuine bullhorn in the front of the bus and we'd slowed down. The bus had lost all braking power and all steering. So it just sort of slowly meandered to it or finished up. And then we got out and there was only Mexican people on there plus two of us, two very, like, very, very white guys, a Polish guy and a Canadian dude. And the Canadian guy grabbed the horn out of the front of the bus, put it in his bag. It was like, this is a keeper. The Polish guy lit up a joint and was like, oh, well, we're going to be here for a while. And then the Canadian guy turned to me and goes, ah, oh, this is actually how the Bandidos get you. They cause tourist buses to crash by putting cows on the front of the road and then they come and kidnap you. Oh, and boy. I was like, mate, don't tell us that. Nah. So we've waited 3 hours. Like
Except the Polish guy who's just chill about the whole situation.
And we'd had these sleeping tablets. So we're in this like really weird, hazy, not sure if we're awake or asleep kind of thing. So for that 2 to 3 hours while we waited for a replacement bus in the middle of nowhere was pretty scary. I reckon that was close to the most hairy thing that we'd done.
But no Bandidos, right? So that Canadian guy is just full of shit. Stop. Thanks for bringing that up, mate. Like, absolute fucking miss. We shit ourselves for 2.5 hours thinking Bandidos were coming, except for the Polish guy who's so stoned he thought somebody said someone was bringing Doritos and he's devastated there's no corn chips.
He was just as sad, just as scared because, mate, the guy was hungry. But there was, because it was like Mexican people just like screaming and crying and that kind of thing. So for that 2 hour period, also, so we're in Peru for another one with another one of my mates, and he got his backpack stolen, and he's diabetic, and he brought two test kits with him, and smart guy left both test kits in the same bag, and then that bag got stolen, and so we were going through like Lake Titicaca and around Cusco. Oh no, we're going the other way into Bolivia, and he didn't have a way to test his sugar, and he's like, this could be the end, and I was like, geez, this is pretty scary stuff. And then, but I still ended up falling asleep on the bus because we had to get a 5 hour bus trip into La Paz.
I guess someone will wake me up if he starts dying. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I'll be woken up if he starts having a seizure next to me. So like, I may as well go to sleep while I can.
I mean, the good news is you'll also be rested and fresh, better able to help him in that scenario, I would say.
Aware, very aware.
If I could immediately transport you, you don't have to go through the travel. You don't need to do all that. Yep. You're just there back to somewhere you visited to be able to visit it again, to have that moment again, to, you know, like bathe under that waterfall or eat that particular meal or whatever it is. But what moment would you just love to have again?
I reckon the easiest question ever. So my mate Joel got married in Folegandros in Greece, which is an island of 500 people. It was 2018, I think, and all of our really close mates flew over there. We had an entire hotel to ourselves. We booked out the entire hotel just with wedding guests. There was 45 people, except for one Italian couple, these two Italian guys who have a standing reservation for that hotel every year. And every morning we'd go for a swim in their budgie smugglers with a set of snorkeling goggles on, and they would swim back and forth. But we had his wedding in the town square of this 500-person island. They brought out souvlaki or gyros at 2 a.m. and we partied until 6 o'clock in the morning. The bride went over to the DJ at 4 o'clock in the morning and was like, oh, I think everyone's ready to go to bed, George. And he said, why? They're still dancing. I'll keep playing if they keep dancing. And so we just sort of partied there until the sun came up. So it was awesome. It was just, we felt like we owned the place, and it was Greece in September. So it was amazing.
Okay. If there's one song that you like, I don't know if you have a version of like a rev up song or like a, just you're going to blast it loud if you need to change your mood song. Is there like a song that comes to mind when I ask that question?
Well, funny from that, it's the song from the physio guys is Bugatti. That like absolute ridiculous song. Whenever, because we also, when we finished uni, we went on a trip to Bali just for a week so we could all be together. And we stayed in a house in a villa that had a bridge over the pool because one of the guys said, I refuse to stay anywhere that doesn't have a bridge over its pool. And then Bugatti got played that whole weekend. So that song I think will always not only transport me back to that night, but it'll get me going, particularly if all the boys are around. That tends to be the one that gets us up.
What do you think the most important life lesson you learnt from travelling was?
I think that the most important lesson from travel, I mean, so you learn a lot of tolerance and things and patience. I'm not a particularly patient person, but I think that it's probably going to be okay. Like, it's no matter what you do, like, we had a bus crash in the middle of the Mexican desert and nothing happened and we still made it out, that most things that you go through, you can get through. Like, it's not going to be a problem. You'll come out the other side. It's just a matter of being patient and thinking through it. Something I try and do a lot that I'm working on. I also thought when I was 18 that by the time I'd be 30, I was, like, finished evolving. Like, I'd be Charizard and I'm done.
Mate, wait until you're 47 and you're looking back just going, fucking hell, I really thought I'd be going forward, not backwards.
So I try and that old, like, think fast, act slow. So I try and do that more now, which helps me act and be a little bit less impulsive, because I can be a bit frantic and a bit quick to move between things and places and ideas without necessarily finishing them. My wife, Rach, likes to call me Mr. 90% because I'll get 90% of the way through something. I'm like, oh, well, that's done. And then I'll start something else. So I try and I'm trying to continue through that a little bit more.
What do you think it is about the 90%? Like, I mean, maybe it speaks to the idea that, like, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that I would say is a strength of mine too is that I understand concepts. I wouldn't consider myself to be the smartest person in the world, but if somebody who is smart explains something to me, I'm good at being able to get it, which means that educationally you can kind of just get through. Does the 90% come from that, do you think? Is that just a like residual of this kid at school who could always just do enough to get what he needed to do and didn't need to do anymore?
It's probably that, and things that are done 90%, they look done. Yeah. No one's like, geez, that's close not enough. Finished.
I mean, yeah, it's 90%.
Like if... Yeah, exactly. It looks done. And like no one's, I mean, 90% finished house is like, oh, they've got a little bit of work to do on the deck, but like the house is finished. Yeah. So like that's why I'll be like, okay, well now I'll move on to the next topic and I'll continue on from there. I reckon that's probably it. But yeah, I also try and surround, I'm really fortunate again, a lot of my mates are really like very intelligent, like super intelligent, really, really dedicated, and they work really hard. So they get that final 10% for me as well. But there's a few of the guys, a lot of my friends are doctors because we all went through college together, and then because I did science, and then we met a few guys from there. And surrounding myself with them is really beneficial because the conversations that they have are on a different level, unless they start talking a bit too technically about potassium levels and then I sort of zone out a little bit.
So what is your role in the friendship group? Does it vary from person to person, or do you have like a consistent sort of like place in the friendship group?
I reckon I bring the non-medical guy. Right. So like they're all the medical dudes. I bring the non-medicine. But then for the physio guys, I'm the organizer, like the booker and the cooker. I'm the guy that is like, all right, we're going here. This is the time. Like we're sorting it out. I'm Mr. Logistics for all that kind of thing. But the thing that always reminds me, particularly of this podcast that I listen to regularly, is a conversation I had with one of my friends, Arthur, who is going to be a neurologist. Like it could be one of, if not the smartest guy I know. We had a conversation on a rooftop in Mount Eliza. We're on a Bucks party. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. We're sitting overlooking the ocean. Arthur's from Singapore and he could have had some scholarship that is like, he was effectively the smartest kid in Singapore 1 year. Like his year of 18 could have been the smartest person in the whole country, which is incredible. And we were overlooking the ocean and we had a 45 minute to an hour conversation about what it is about an ocean view that is so appealing, because you can't do anything with an ocean view. You can't, like, it doesn't actually provide you physically with anything. Like, why is it a desirable thing to have an ocean view, and why is it considered generally more desirable than like a forest view? So we sat down.
Why?
And we nutted it out.
I mean, give me the gist. Don't give me the whole hour because, you know, we don't have the time. But
like, I'll give you the end.
Yeah. What's your conclusion?
The conclusion was that because you can see out into the ocean, it's one, safety, because you can see anything that's incoming, because if you've got a forest, then you don't necessarily know what's mm-hmm. coming. And also the
danger
ocean
could be lurking in the forest.
Exactly.
Whereas rarely the danger in the ocean can't really make it past the sand.
Exactly. But also that the ocean is seen as plentiful with like potential for food. And also water is like a life force. So having that there too, even though you can't drink it because it'll dehydrate you, which is quite an ironic twist. But there, you think like, oh yeah, I could go fishing and catch something out there, whereas you could be wandering around the forest for a while. So that was one of the more enjoyable conversations I had. And also 3am, so it's always good fun there too.
Yeah. By the way, one of the smartest things the planet ever did was made the majority of the water on the planet undrinkable by humans. Because if we were able to drink it, imagine how much quicker we would have fucked up everything on the planet. Like,
I know.
If you could go down, how many people would be at Bondi if you could just sunbake and also have a delicious drink?
The beach might be a little bit bigger. Everything, the countries might be a bit bigger because we probably would have drunk through the water a lot quicker, I reckon.
Yeah, I love the water. I can't explain it, but I totally get, you know, what you're talking about. And, like, I would love that conversation. I've been very lucky. I'm in lockdown also, but in Sydney and where I live, you know, in a way, lockdown's been great for the area because there's no one visiting. It's like, it's a place that, you know, on the weekends and stuff can be quite full of people. But the great news is people can't travel to the area. So during the week and stuff, I really can walk along the harbour and the beach and stuff, you know, by myself or with only a few people around. And it feels like a great luxury of life. You know, I feel very fortunate that I can spend my day doing that in my like hour of exercise outside the house. It's pretty cool. But I can't explain it. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I feel it, but I can't explain it. But I love seeing the water every day. Like it is, yeah. And I must not be the only one because people pay a lot of money for houses that are right next to the water. And particularly they know the oceans are rising. So that is a risky investment, to be honest with you.
I mean, ocean's rising and the banks are eroding. So you're genuinely getting closer and closer to the water. But maybe that's part of the attraction, that it has some level of like finite amount to it, that you know that you probably won't own it by the time that the ocean has risen to a level that you have to move out.
Yeah, that's right. I will be the last person who owns this beautiful place because it'll be underwater for the next generation.
Legacy.
If you could live anywhere in the world, where would you want to live? Like, are you living where you would want to live anywhere in the world? Or is there another place that if you had, you know, the opportunity, you'd just love to live?
I think I'm Melbourne. I think Melbourne is my place. I think it's got all, I'm a massive sports fan. So I will see all the sport when it's on. There's so much happening. I'm also, because I'm red hair, very pale skin, I don't need the sun. I'm nothing over like 24 degrees. I don't really get the beach, but I also don't get the beach because like there's never any toilets anywhere. So like, what if you need to do a poo? So it's really hard to like make your way around there. So I don't need heat and I quite enjoy the like the camaraderie, I guess, that is forged in fire by the cold weather. Man, I love 17 degrees. It's at the moment, it's like 14 degrees, but there's not a cloud in the sky. That's a treat. I love that. But I just love being, don't get me wrong, I love New York. New York's awesome. Went there. That was incredible. But I find it quite suffocating after a while because you're never out of New York. But I think Melbourne is my place and where we live at the moment. Man, I could live here forever.
Okay, so you know I ask people on this show if they have a life philosophy of any kind. We've talked about a bunch of stuff already, but do you have something that sums up your life philosophy, saying that you knew this question was coming?
I think about this every time I listen, and it brings me back to my mates all give me heaps of shit for being like a guy who loves sayings and who loves like quips and things like that. And my wife at our wedding reception brought it up and was like, Adam, you're a guy who loves sayings. You love to just have little things that you live your life by. And the three that she picked were manners cost nothing as number one. Number two is if you're going to get wet, you might as well go swimming. And then the third one is you're not too busy. You're just not willing to sacrifice. And that the third one sounds quite harsh, but that's what I tell myself to stop myself from being lazy or not wanting to do something or not wanting to see someone, not wanting to call someone, not wanting to text someone, not wanting to ask if they're okay. I really, the busyness part is something that I try and get out of my system. As much as I try and frame that lucky and fortunate the right way, I try and not say I'm busy because everybody's busy, everyone's got their own shit going on. So doing that stops me from giving myself an out. So the third one is I wouldn't recommend it to use. I use it as like a negative self-motivator more than anything else.
What do you think about the power of a negative self-motivator? Because I am fascinated by what we use to motivate ourselves. And I think I am a real mess of all things. Like sometimes I need something positive, but I think most of the time you know, like something negative is probably more likely to, like, I used to tell this story like for years about this teacher who said to me that I wasn't funny and I was never going to be funny. And like, I would like for years tell that story, like so angry at this teacher, this real sort of like, fuck you, look at what I've done with my life sort of like way that I would tell this story. But I realized later in life that so much of my motivation to do well was like driven by, you know, I mean, she was probably, you know, she was my Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society, you know, giving me the, really like a burning motivation inside to prove it wrong.
Well, I think for me, it's really good. I wouldn't recommend it for everyone. I think it would be good for some and not for other. And that's like another thing that I try and live by is that the answer more often than not will lie somewhere in the middle. Like that saying that you're not too busy, you're just not willing to sacrifice is good for some people, but it's not good for everyone. And like it's like everything, most things in life are like an English essay. Like it is Romeo and like, is Romeo a good person in Romeo and Juliet? And it's like, well, yeah, he's good. Not that I know Romeo and Juliet that well, but like when you write an English essay, it's always like he has good aspects, but he also has some detracting aspects to his personality as well. So most of the time I try and live by that as well. So I wouldn't recommend everybody lives by, you're not too busy, just not willing to sacrifice, but some people might find it helpful.
Right.
To do that.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, I think the greatest piece of genius out of all of that is the, you know, what I like to call the different strokes maxim, which is what might be right for you may not be right for some. You know, like everybody moves the beat of a different drum, and it seems to be, you know, this is, I think, the conversation that we lose so often in our society. We see things in such black and whites when we realize that, like, you are different to your wife and I am different to my partner. We believe in very different things. We love each other and we've come together and, you know, we agree on a lot of things, but we have very different opinions on a whole bunch of other things. That's the person I choose to hang out with all the time. Why would I judge people that I'm not hanging out with all the time for having a range of other opinions that at least try to understand what those motivations are or what their stresses might be or the weight that it's on their shoulders? It's, I think this time has been a time where we've needed so much empathy as a society, and we've found it really hard to keep our empathy up because we're just not used to it being like a really necessary quality for survival. Like, we lived in this world previously to the pandemic, which it was all a bit like survival the fittest and see how well you can make out for yourself. And then suddenly that wasn't really necessary to us for a while. What was necessary was look after each other and understand that other people are going through things and give them more time and give them the sort of empathy you would like extended to you. And oh, that's do unto others. Sorry. Now I've started. Yeah. Good Catholic boy. You'll understand what I'm saying.
Yes, yes, I do. Yeah.
So where do you fall on that? Like, during the pandemic, has it made you think about how human beings interact with each other?
I think so. I think I've just been most disappointed. I don't know if it's disappointed. I'm not sure the emotion that's attached to it, but a feeling that people, it's because everybody, like, I feel that everybody judges everybody else by their own standards. And like, I'm also not great at that. That's one of my greatest weaknesses, is that I will be disappointed if someone doesn't live up to the standards that I hold for myself. But I try not to then impress that on someone. And I think the fact that a lot of people at the moment, particularly with social media and everything, they feel like they have agency over other people and they feel like their decision should be used for that other person, how it should work. I mean, just because, like, everybody's obviously entitled to their opinion, but you don't have to, not everyone has to say their opinion. Like, you can sometimes stay quiet. Yeah, so
sometimes you can just, like, shush it, keep it to yourself. It's your opinion.
But I think that the agency that everyone feels that they have and the right that they have to decide for everybody else what they should do and how they should act and what they shouldn't do, it just then draws it back and it causes an animosity and it creates that binary existence, which, again, like, most of the time the world's not black and white, it's gray. Most of the time the answer's somewhere in the middle, apart from like a few things, like obviously like gay marriage and that kind of thing. But obviously you should be able to get married, do whatever you like, it doesn't bother me. But the amount of people that try and take agency over things that will also not affect them and that have no impact on them whatsoever, it's just mind-blowing.
Okay, so I'm conscious of the fact that we've already been talking for 52 minutes and we haven't spoken about one thing. And it was very kind that you said that you listened to the show, and I don't know how aware you are of the fact that I'm a big fan of your show. I talk about it quite a lot on my other podcasts. I don't talk about it quite as much on Willosophy, but you appear on the television show Gogglebox. In fact, you've just come back to the television show Gogglebox after being away for a while. But my journey with Gogglebox, I'll give you my little sort of previously on McLeod's Daughters, which was when I first heard about it as a show, I thought we had reached the absolute bottom of the barrel when it came to television. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? We are going to have a show where people are going to sit around and watch fucking television. This is the worst idea. This is it. This is Popper's eating itself and shit itself back out. We're fucking done. Shut the whole thing down. And then I have become, like, it's my favorite show. I absolutely fucking love it. I just think it's, like, I love the Australian version. I absolutely adore the British version. I've watched every season of the British version. It does not matter that most of the time I don't know the shows they're talking about, because the secret of the show is that it's not really about the shows. It's about getting to know all these different people from different walks of life, and you get to know them through this central premise, which is the television shows they're watching and how they react to those television shows. And each week that central conceit tells you a story, this unfolding narrative in the lives of these people, where you get to peer into their lounge rooms and their living rooms and see how they do what we all do when we sit down to watch television. It's fucking amazing. I love it. It's edited so well. It's so funny. It's so charming. I feel like I have real life relationships with all the fucking people on the show. I once fucking, like, I'm not easily intimidated, but I once ran into Jad at like a pub in Sydney and got too embarrassed to get a photo. Like, literally, like, yeah, I have like a, so I need to get that out on the table first before we talk about Gogglebox. So, and I'll also say this. Of course, I work in the television industry, which means occasionally my work is discussed on the television show Gogglebox, which I find incredibly confronting, because every time I know one of my shows is going to be on the show, I'm just like, I don't want to not like any of these people. Don't any of my favorite characters say something mean about me. And then I have to, but anyway, so all that's my big, you know, blurted confession in case you were not aware. So tell me now, how did you get involved in this show? Because you took a leap of faith. Like, I now can, in retrospect, understand the, you know, the qualities of the show and why it works and why it's so interesting. But like, tell me the story of you and Gogglebox.
Well, first, that's incredibly kind, Will, and very humbling to hear, because, yeah, I've watched your stuff for a long, long time and been to a lot of your stand-up shows and really have loved them and appreciated them too. So that's very, very nice to hear. And it's, yeah, very, very, very humbling. But we were much like you. So we were at the pub, Simon and I. We were 10 mates at the Turf Club Hotel in Flemington, which is now student apartments. And we were there and a lady came over and said, hey, I've been watching your group of 10 for a while and I'm casting for a show called Gogglebox. I think you guys would be great for it. And we said, no, thanks, lady. That sounds terrible. And she said, no, trust me. It's really big in England. It's really, really great. And we said, no, thanks. Please leave us alone. It's Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m. We're just trying to have a beer. We just finished classes. And she was like, no, trust me. Give me one more chance. It's about people watching people watch TV. And we said, that is the worst idea ever. We are not interested in the slightest. That sounds absolutely terrible. Like you, TV's eating itself and they've run out of ideas. So now they're doing this. And then she said, no, trust me, wrote her name down and her email down on the flyer. I put it in my back pocket. We went out that night, had a few too many beers, woke up in the morning in the same pants that I was wearing from the night before, found the flyer in my back pocket and was like, I'll text a couple of the guys. They all said no, except for Simon, who said, I will do it if you do all of the admin. And me being the admin organization guy, did all the admin. And all the admin was one email to her. And then that was where it went from there. Because we said to each other, maybe if we get on TV, we'll get to go to the Logies and drink some free beers. And then that was the only reason that we said yes. But we actually got asked, we got confirmed to go on the show when I was in Peru. Simon was in Frisco in Texas. We were both on university placement and they said, hey, we need you back on this date. And we said, oh, sorry, our flights are already booked and like we don't want to cut our holiday short by 4 days. And they go, oh no. They go, we'll pay for your flights back. And we were like, oh, how is this TV money? Have a look at this. So they flew us back. I mean, we were like, we're getting business. How good is this? We sat like second back row, obviously, and then flew back and cut our holiday short by 4 days and got back. And that was 6 or 7 years ago now. I think that was the end of 2014.
When did you know that it was something? Because you don't have experience. So, like, I mean, for me, like, I always think people who, like, it's why I have a great deal of empathy for, like, reality stars and these sort of people who go from nothing to being quite well known, or at least, you know, famous in that way that people, you know, recognize their face or their name, even if they don't entirely know what it is that they do. You haven't been prepared for it. Like, by the time that people started to know who I was, I'd been doing stand-up for years. You've had smaller versions of the process. Yeah, there's a few people who know who you are, a few people who keep coming back to your gigs. You get guest appearances on some shows, you get your own show, it gradually builds. But suddenly you are just dropped into the middle of show business. Like, you know, you're at uni, you're doing physio, you're playing footy with your mates, and now you're like on a TV show watching television. That's a show. When did you know, when did you know that it had struck a chord in some way?
I think it was about halfway through season one, or maybe the start of season two, we got told by the production company that it had become one of Foxtel's highest rating non-sports shows. And they were like, it's really big. And then it moved to a better time slot. And we were like, oh, wow, people are actually watching this. But because, man, if you actually, if you like edit down all of the footage of Simon and I, there's, so at the start, there's 10 families. The show goes for 40 minutes. There's probably 20 minutes of that like the actual TV show, so recaps. Then between all those other 10 families, if you split that evenly, there's 2 minutes of us on TV per week. It was on once a week for 8 episodes to start, or 10 episodes to start, twice a year. So like we weren't on TV enough to be really recognized in the street, and we weren't really like getting ahead of ourselves because it was really just, it's a part-time job. Like we still were going to uni and doing all our other things. And then all our mates would keep our feet grounded. Like none of our mates watch it. They've never watched it and still don't watch it. So like we never really had the chance to be like, oh, we're the big dicks here. Like we're the big dicks in town. So I think, and maybe that's part of the like country upbringing, is it's like, don't get ahead of yourself. Try and keep your feet grounded a little bit, where we, because we call it the Holy Trinity. If we're going to get recognized, it's if we're out in public. If we're together, so if we're out in public at a big event like the footy, if we're together, and if people are pissed,
yeah.
And so if those three things are together, then people go like, "Oh, do I recognize you? Do you work at my local Bunnings? Did you go to school with my kids? That kind of thing." So we mostly just get confusion, and we still do. So I don't think we, yeah, I don't think we ever really have fully gotten ahead of ourselves. Well, not yet, anyway.
But people see the trick of the show for people who are just casual viewers who've never seen it is, it's not really about, yeah, it's not like a TV criticism show. It's not a whole bunch of people sitting around making, often, you know, the clip they will choose to get people to talk about might be a certain discussion point that was on the show. So the conversation in the living rooms might be less about the television show itself and more about the issue that they were discussing. Really, the show is like you're checking back in with each of these like couples or families or like relationships, friends, whatever, and getting more clues to who they are. You know, they're just characters in a story. So suddenly you're just a person, but you're also a character in a story, and you're being portrayed at least in, like, yeah, once you start seeing edits, you get an idea of how the production people see you as well. So once you start seeing yourself being edited, were you more aware of, like, at least how they were trying to define you, or like did it reveal anything? Like did seeing yourself portrayed by somebody else give you any insight into who you were?
I think slightly, but I think we were like, we always, it's always edited really well together, like you said, but I think that we, yeah, like our identity was, because the show's so diverse, like the show's really, really fantastic in the families that it shows and the breadth that it shows in family setups and friend setups and that kind of thing. And we were always,
and culturally, like, we just, and diverse, yes, as well. Like incredibly culturally diverse. Like one, yeah, of the great strengths of the program is that it shows absolutely the whole gamut of, like, you know, relationships.
Yeah, I think the only all one of the only demographics that is missing on the show is a First Nations family. That's probably the only one that's missing at the moment, because there's Sri Lankan families, there's Lebanese families, there's Greek families, there's like, and we the joke we make very heavily tongue in cheek at the moment is people love us because they love to see diversity. They love seeing two white guys just on TV. It's just really great to see a couple of white guys getting a crack for once. But yeah, we were a mix between the gag, the funny line from the show, as well as because we were portrayed as the uni students and the educated ones that we were also relied upon and probably still are to an extent to provide a little bit of like an educated rounding thought. That was until Kerry Silbury turned up on the screen and they went to her because she's super smart as well. And then we got shunted. Then we got moved back down the pecking order a little bit as well.
Has it... because I'm not going to ask about the secrets. I'll ask you that another time. Yep. We'll grab a beer at some stage and I'll ask you all the secrets of how it's made and, you know, all that stuff, because I am fascinated.
Well, the thing with this show is that, like, because people always want to ask about it, but we never want to reveal behind the curtain, because, like, you don't want to show how the cookie's made. Like, behind the scenes is not like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. There's not, like, Augustus Gloop heading into the Chocolate River or anything like that. So we, try and keep a little bit of the allure of the show, because you don't want to see behind the curtain at all.
Yeah.
But,
so for the general public, that would be completely non-fascinating. They would be disappointed by what I, on the other hand, have 25 questions. I have a whole unedited podcast, unrecorded podcast, I'm sorry to say, that I have a lot of questions. I would love to know. It's one of those shows that I'd love to meet, you know, the people who edit it. I'd love to talk to the showrunners about, like, you know, what their storytelling philosophy is, because that's what I love about it. I think just the balance and the storytelling and stuff, just from a technical and professional point of view, I find really incredibly well done. Like, you know, it's funny. It's anyway, whatever. Like, that's a conversation for another time. You left the show.
We did. So,
spoilers, they're back. But you did leave the show. Why did you leave the show?
We thought we got to the end of 5 years, 10 seasons. We're like, oh, geez, they're nice and round numbers. Mm. But we also, because part of the charm of the show is that you don't do anything outside of the show, because that's who you are. You are just regular people sitting on the couch, and that's why people connect with it so much, because everyone on there is like a family they know, or a friend they know, or a cousin or anything like that. And their cousins and friends and family don't go and do other TV shows and do like hosting and that kind of thing, and we thought that we could use it as a bit of a springboard, almost like we're the 19-year-olds that are ready to go and travel. Like, we were ready to do our own thing and go out on our own and try a few different things, and we got a few opportunities through Melbourne City, the football club, Melbourne Stars, the cricket team. We were ambassadors for Movember. We were doing a little bit of late night radio on Sundays, and then we got our own show on Fox Footy once a week, and then the pandemic hit, so we lost. We're first one out the door for the radio, and then that never came back. And then our footy show lasted a grand total of one episode, and then that never came back. And then we sort of just lost a lot of the grind and a lot of the work from there. So all these grand plans just sort of fell in a heap a little bit.
How did you deal with that? Like, I mean, I've been it's been a mixed bag for me. I lost a lot of stuff. I gained a couple of things. Like, you know, in the end, I'll call it a really valiant, like, you know, one of those losses where you're like, you know what, both teams are happy. The team that won, you know, they won by a considerable margin, but we put up a good fight in hard circumstances. But that's a lot of stuff. You know, you've gone out on your own, you suddenly have all these opportunities, and then through no fault of your own, those opportunities, you know, pretty much immediately all at the same time go away. What was that like? How did you deal with that?
I mean, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't disappointing, but I think the greatest thing that we have is that we have each other. So I vividly remember there was one night in the middle of last year in the long lockdown where I was on the couch and I just started crying to Rach, to my wife, and I was just like, this sucks. Nothing's happening. This is a real waste of time. But then you talk to Simon on the other side, and that day he might be feeling good, so he picks you up and lifts you up. So doing it with one of your best mates is always great, because it just provides a little bit of perspective, and it provides the thought that you can't have when you're by yourself if you're a little bit down or disappointed or upset or angry or frustrated that the other person goes, mate, it's okay. But and then at the same time, if you're both feeling the same, then you've got someone to bounce off on and just absolutely go to town on all of the stuff that's going bad in your life, and they really understand it like that. Esoteric life, that they really get what you're going through. So having someone to do that as well, and as well as having a wife who's really understanding and listens fantastically, I think that helped pull us through. And we sort of, one thing we're never afraid to do is work. One thing we're never, because like we still work full time as physios, as well as run our podcast, film for the show, and then try and organize and get some other stuff up in the background. So one thing we'll never be afraid of is, again, like I said, you're not too busy, you're just not willing to sacrifice to myself, that I'll try and get through it. So, I mean, was never fully despondent and thought about giving up, but yeah, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a bit disappointed that it all sort of fell in a heap.
I'm always curious. It's one of my pet topics that I am fascinated about, which is the professional friendship. So you guys are mates. And then suddenly you're professionally mates. You know, you're like, you're Hamish and Andy. You are like one of those, you know, groups that people just associate with each other. Like you said, you recognize when you're together, you know. And have you had to negotiate that? Did it change the nature of your friendship, the fact that it was, you know, suddenly also your friendship was also your job?
Well, I think it's only strengthened it, to be honest, which is, again, incredibly fortunate because we balance out really well. So I'm the first 90% and Simon's the last 10, as in he's brilliant at finishing things off and running the way all the way through to the finish line, as well as he's a lot more creative than I am, whereas I'm a lot more organizational. So we're able to, like, we're two halves, we're half a person each and together we are one, but we've always, we run everything through a prism that, is it going to be fun? That's our first thought. So like if we get offered something or if we have the chance to pitch something or talk to someone, the first thought we ask each other is this going to be fun? And if the answer is yes, we do it. And then even when we're halfway through, we turn to each other and we say, are you still having fun? And then he will ask me the same question. And if the answer is no, then we came to the, we had a chat really early on and it was, if one of us doesn't want to do it, then we're both not doing it. Much like the, if we're going to get wet, we might as well go swimming, but the inverse, where if someone doesn't want to get in the pool, neither of us are getting in the pool. Like we're, yeah, really, really fortunate to have each other because I think, well, we just have so much fun together. So, I mean, that's at a very base level. It's very simple, but we run that through that prism of, are we going to have a good time? And can we make other people have a good time around us as well?
Obviously, we get to this point of the podcast. What do you reckon happens when we die? Obviously, you know, you went to Catholic college. There must have been some some religion in your life, at least at some stage. Is there still any of it there? What do you reckon happens?
Well, mate, I went to a Catholic college, but I studied a Bachelor of Science. Yeah. So they're like quite conflicting ideas. I don't think anything. I think it's the electricity when it gets turned off. It's fully done. I mean, I've been concussed or knocked out a few times and, mate, nothing happens when I'm knocked out, so I can't imagine anything happens when I'm finished, which is a bit unfortunate.
Yeah, okay. So you do feel like that's a bit unfortunate?
Yeah. I mean, it would be fantastic if there was something else, but I just don't think that there is, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I wish I felt like that, but I'm tired. You're younger than me. I'm like, it's fine. I don't need there to be a whole other thing once I'm done. Once I'm done, I'm happy to be done.
Like you said, you're like having trouble enough finishing, like you've still got to evolve at 47. I'm like doing that at 30. So if you've got to keep evolving when you're like 150, mate, that's
exhausting,
sounds tough.
Mate. Absolutely exhausting. okay, so how do you rationalize, because this is the question that's at the heart of the show, I guess, really, which is that if you don't believe that there is any, you know, sort of greater purpose or plan or, you know, afterlife or any of those sort of things, what is the meaning of life? Why do you think that human beings are, I mean, obviously, like you said, you studied science. I get the science. Let's take the science as being true. You know, I'm very happy to like, you know, evolution, the whole thing, you know, how humans work, all those sort of things. But is there more than that? Because to me, the gap between that scientific explanation, and then why do we get moved by that particular song or that particular memory? Why is our society organized in this way? Why are there works of art or whatever, sport, that can, you know, inspire us in ways that we can't quite explain? What is that? What is the magic of humanity? What is the point of humanity?
Well, I think that, again, it's very science. Like, I think they're at a very base level, it's to pass your genetics on and to like it is in the rest of the animalistic world. And like, sport is exciting and created because it's the closest thing to like to battle, like they used to have way back when there would be one tribe that would be superior, and then that tribe would then be able to dominate and then pass on their genetics more effectively and that kind of thing. So I think that from why are we actually here, I reckon it's a really disappointing science answer. But how do I rationalize that, thinking that that is the case, that then it comes back to that because I know it's only a finite period, I try and do everything that's going to be fun and make the most of the period of time and that finite period of time that I have here. But, mate, I would still love to live to 120.
Okay, so but if you're living to 120, what's your life look like at 120?
When I'm 120 years old?
Yeah.
I'm still walking around. I reckon. Either that, I've said to Rach, I've said, if something ever happens to me, anything really bad, sit me in like a really comfortable chair, put four TV screens up in front of me and run like ESPN on one, Fox Footy on the other, and like all of the sports channels on all of them. And then I can, mate, I will watch baseball for days. I will watch American football. I will watch English soccer. It doesn't matter. I will watch whatever it is and I will be content at being there. So if I'm 120 and I'm watching like 10 different sports in a day, then I'm happy.
Yeah, I am a bit with you in that one, which is like there's so much stuff to catch up on. Yeah. Even the pandemic, I'm still not on top of everything. So like I can sit in a chair for the last 20 years of my life 100%. And be brought food while I catch up on my shows.
My grand idea is to, when all my mates, so I've when we all hit an age where we need to go into a home, we all sell our houses, but then we buy like a mega mansion in like the country or Toorak or something, and then we have a retirement home that's just our mates. Because so I work in aged care, and loneliness is obviously a massive factor on it, and they want to see their friends and their family and that kind of thing a lot more. But, mate, if I surround myself with all of my mates – and
all your mates.
And we've got a mega mansion in like Toorak or something. Because like chances are one of us is going to be rich. Arthur the neurologist is going to be worth a fortune. And I'm going to be absolutely sponging off him that you need to, like there's going to need to be a give from the person who gets rich and a little bit of take from the person who's not so rich. But we all live in a massive mansion, employ some nurses and doctors. And, oh, mate, we've got enough doctors. We'll get them for free. They'll have kids who are doctors and they'll have kids who are doctors. So, mate, we're sweet on that front. But I just see myself being around my friends for forever.
What a great way to revolutionise aged care, by the way. Like, I mean, I would love that for your last years of your life. Like, you know, you got such money or whatever. You sell your house, you know, if you got a house or whatever, right? And you just get to live out your last days with your mates.
Yep.
Like you said, it would absolutely solve that problem of people feeling lonely and neglected. They'd be like, oh, God, my family's visiting too much. I want to get back to the boys.
Yeah, you know? I've got 10 mates and in 70 years' time, everyone's house is worth $10 million. Everyone sells their houses. Yeah. You can't tell me I can't buy a $70 million mansion estate with 10 rooms and we can all live in there. Like, and then use whatever we didn't spend.
You don't even need that. I mean, 10 rooms is fine, but you don't even need... Like, as long as you've got a couple of good TVs and, like, whatever it is you'd like to do at that age, like, it's not like you need expansive gardens and stuff. That's just, like, upkeep.
Yep.
You just need, like, a good solid pad with all the conveniences exactly. that you need as an old person.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of toilets. 10 bedrooms and 10 toilets minimum would be my suggestion.
100%. 100%.
Okay. So, when you're at your best, what does that look like? When you're absolutely flying, when you feel like, oh, this is me being 100% me, what does that look like?
I asked my wife this and she said you're at your best when you're either with your friends, like surrounded by your friends and the ones that you love, or you're doing something for them. Like if I'm trying to organize or if I'm trying to arrange something for one of my friends or for her, that's when I feel like I'm at my most optimal. That's when I'm functioning at 100% is when I'm, either around them and surrounded by them or doing something for them.
And when are you at your worst?
Probably when I get to 90% and I decided I'm finished.
the old 90% knockoff.
I think it's when I get scattered and try and take on too much, or if I try and micromanage projects and things like that. I think I can, yeah, I know when I've got too much going on and I'm a bit scattered and a bit quick to move from thing to thing. So when I don't even reach 90% is probably when I'm at my worst, when I hit 40 and I'm like, yeah, that'll do. And you're like, mate, the house doesn't have a roof.
Final meal, if you could only eat one more meal. You're not on death row. You're just getting a final meal. So what is the meal that you would eat as your final meal?
This is also a conversation I have with Rach all the time when we go for a long drive. Entree is I had this marin pasta. So like marin, like the shellfish from WA from Tippo in Melbourne, this pasta restaurant. It was incredible. That's the entree. Main is the slow cooked lamb that we had at a restaurant in Athens and with these like roast potatoes, which is a very country thing to have, like a big roast for main. And then dessert was this ricotta cheesecake that we had from a place in Bologna called Trattoria di Via Sera. It was incredible, like absolutely just, yeah, transformative.
Do you ever think you'll go back to the country? I mean, apart from the mansion you're buying with your mates to, you know, retire in, but could you imagine a time where you move away from the city, or do you think you're in the city for the foreseeable future?
City for the definitely for the foreseeable future. I can't ever see myself going back somewhere as small as Corowa. My mum and dad are still in Wangaratta, so that's enough country for me. After I've been back there for a couple of days, I'm ready to roll back into the city. But if I somehow win the lotto or get rich or something like that, I could see myself buying a beach house with a nice ocean view, so I feel safe and could see the plentiful ocean in front of me. And then I would buy like an apartment in East Melbourne so I could walk to the MCG or get wheeled there as a 120-year-old man so I could still go and see my Brisbane Lions play.
What was the greatest moment that you've watched the Brisbane Lions play? Like, have you been to premierships? Have you seen them like win a premiership?
No, unfortunately missed the 01, 2 and 3 premierships because I was... We used to go on family trips to see my Nana and Grandpa in Port Macquarie. So I missed all of those. But still the moment, and if I'm hungover and I need a little bit of a cathartic cry, I get on YouTube and I watch the last 2 minutes of the 52-point comeback against the Cats when Ash McGrath kicks the goal after the siren and Anthony Hudson's calling, and like it gets me every time. I could watch it now and cry. It is... There's something about watching the Lions, and maybe it's because I'm not great at expressing my emotions in other ways, and that's my catharsis. But there's something about watching the Lions that, like, it's a genuine emotional experience, and I'm sure you have or have had a similar thing with the Doggies as well.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I mean, not to rub this in your face, but I was lucky enough to be at all three of the Lions premierships.
Yeah,
and I did. Look, I'd had a big day at one of the days, and I ran about 30 like rows down to the fence to give Michael Voss a high five while he was holding the cup. And to this day, I do not regret one moment of the fact that I was pushing women and children out of the way to get to Vossy.
And I would trade positions with you if I could, rather than be at Nana and Tarpa's place in Port Macquarie.
Yeah, we speak to each other in grand final week, in fact. So my Bulldogs play in only the second time I've ever seen them play in the grand final, obviously, in my lifetime. That obviously the last one was 2016, which, you know, seems quite recent. You know, when you wait that long, you know, the idea that we're back again and have a chance to win another one is super exciting. But in 2016, AFL 360, which is a program I'm sure you're familiar with, they do little packages, you know, of the highlights of the game, and they'll use radio commentators or comments from, you know, people in the game. And so I'd been on AFL 360 the Friday night before the game, and I'd done this sort of little, like, you know, speech about how I thought the Bulldogs were going to win. And then on Monday night after the grand final, I tuned into AFL 360, and their like first 6 minute package about, like, with all, like, you know, all the, you know, Bevo and like Bob and, like, you know, everyone's in this thing, right? And but the whole, like, narrative of it is my stuff from the Friday night show that they put over the top of, like, you know, Tom Boyd kicking his goal and all those sort of things. And I'm just like, well, you know what? If nothing else happens for the rest of my life, whenever I'm sad, I can just go onto YouTube and watch that package.
Brilliant. I actually reckon the doggies will win. I reckon I'll put it market here that I think the doggies will roll them.
Yeah, I hope so too. I think there's a good chance that we might, you know, but Melbourne are a very good team. And I genuinely mean this. And again, this is before the game, so I can say I genuinely mean this. In 2016, it was actually really remarkable because the Sydney fans, although they were absolutely devastated that their team didn't win. I mean, AFL premierships are incredibly hard to win. And, you know, it's really sad if your team doesn't. I'll be devastated if the Bulldogs don't. But I know how amazing it was to feel that feeling of seeing my team be successful after all those years of them not being successful, my entire lifetime of them not really being successful. And I feel like if Melbourne get that, if Melbourne fans get that exact same thing, I will be very happy for them. I'll be disappointed that my team lost, but I will be very happy for them. Not so happy that I don't want us to win. That's what I will say. Yeah. I need to point that out for the record. I still want us to win, but if we don't, I think it will be a very great game. So on my desk right here in front of me, I have a little piece of metal of some kind, and inscribed in it, it says, "What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail?" What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail?
I would quit my physio job. I'd quit it tomorrow, and I would try and do some work with Simon full time. If we knew that we were going to be successful, we would probably both quit our physio jobs, and I'm speaking for him, but I assume this is the case. Hope it's the case anyway. That we would might be in trouble if it's not. We would quit and then like host something or just find a way to get in for that. Because I think, I mean, the main thing that's holding us back at the moment is like, man, we need to pay rent and bills and life and expenses and things like that. So we still work full-time as physios. But, if I knew I was going to be successful, I'd quit tomorrow.
I have a time machine. Oh, what can we plug? You have a podcast that we should tell people about. Obviously, people should watch Gogglebox.
Yeah.
And they were very kind about my new show, Question Everything, which people can still watch on ABC iView. There's my plug. But people can watch Gogglebox. You have a podcast, though. Tell us about that.
It's just ingeniously called The Adam and Simon Show. It's just like...
And who's on it?
There's Adam and Simon, and we actually just fired we just fired the guy named Show. We had a third guy called Show, who's actually my brother-in-law, and we had him because he was the only guy who knew how to edit audio and post a podcast that we knew. So he was the reason that he stuck around, and then he's decided that he's got more busy things in life to do. So there's me and Simon, and now we've got a third voice called Cassie on there. Her name's Cassie. She's lovely. But we just talk about ridiculous things. Like at the moment, I'm trying to set up an OnlyFans for Simon's feet and sell feet pics find us a way to make some cash. And I mean, we just talk about the minutiae of
how much cash do you think you could make out of his feet?
From what we've heard, there is a
market.
Mate, we've reached out to the foot community and they've said $4,000 to $5,000 a week. So maybe I will be able to quit my physio job tomorrow.
Hang on, what?
Yeah.
$4,000 to $5,000.
Yeah. It's a lot of money. Yeah.
I wish I'd known this at the start of the pandemic.
No. And then we just talk about the stupid things that go on in our life, like Simon forgot to put the handbrake on his car, and I mean, we're just two white guys on a podcast, you know, something just trying to have a laugh.
I mean, here's what I will say is that I mean, you guys, if anyone's going to be able to sell their foot photos at like a highly inflated rate, because you've been dangling your feet out in front of the nation on Gogglebox, like, you know, but with socks. Like, it's that real sort of old school, oh, I wonder what's under there, you know? Like,
well, mate, the only reason that we put the socks on was because in the first season, if you look, our feet are actually bare and they face the camera, and it looked like we had really dirty feet. And we were like, we don't have dirty feet. We tried to have a shower before shooting and they'd still look dirty. So we just started putting socks on and it took off from there. But Simon reckons he's got really attractive feet. He's got the weird like second toe that's a bit longer, but he reckons it's good. So, I mean, we're going to try and make some cash out of him somehow.
The fact that he's been depriving the nation of those feet for free for all these years. No, he might as well monetize it.
Exactly.
I have a time machine. I can take you to any point in the future, any point in the past. Purely selfish mission is what I always like to say. This one's for you. So would you go to the future or the past?
Past, definitely the past, for sure.
And okay, so do you have a specific moment, time, or place that you want to go to?
Yeah, so I obviously think about this one a lot too, and my first thought is generally go back to that night in Greece to my mate Joel and Kath's wedding. But then I also don't want to tarnish it by going back there and viewing it and being like, oh, it wasn't actually as good as I thought. So I reckon I would go back to both of my grandfathers, my mum's dad was in the British Navy. He's an Englishman. He was born and grew up in Windsor. And then my dad's dad was in the Australian Navy. And they were both like, well, my mum's dad's still alive. He's 98. He's incredible. He still goes to the gym 5 times a week. He just can't see, but he's a brilliant, an incredibly lovely guy. But he's really secretive about what his life was like when he was in the Navy, in the British Navy. And he married my nana after knowing her for like 3 months, met her in Bondi, was like, yeah, you're perfect. Married her. They were together for like 60 years. But I want to know what he was doing like when he was in Boston or like when he was in London or New York. And at the same time, my dad's dad was in the Navy, and apparently he was like in submarines, chasing other submarines and doing things like that, that he would say to my grandma. So dad's one of four, and he would say to my grandma, like, I've got to leave. And he couldn't tell her where he was going or what he was doing, almost like Naval Secret Service. And I would just love to be a fly on the wall for either a night out with my grandpa in like Boston in New York in the 40s, 50s or whatever, and then with my grandpa chasing submarines in the ocean somewhere.
Mate, this has been a pleasure. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you. I've loved it.
We're done. That's it, mate.
Awesome. Thanks, mate.